This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
There were thousands of people storming. You got bomb sirens going off every 12 minutes, every 15 minutes. So then you're in the train station. Then you have to run outside, go to the metro for a bomb shelter. Then the sirens stop. Then you go back into the train. So then we try to compromise. And we got a taxi to the border of Poland for $1,000.
As the Russian invasion of Ukraine has gathered in intensity, something like a million refugees have left the country. And not only Ukrainians, but foreigners too, people who are in the country to study or travel. Johan Nell is South African, and he was only in Kiev to get a visa. He'd been there a few days when the fighting broke out.
We got to the border of Ukraine, or not exactly, because there was a line of cars, traffic going into the border, but about 25 kilometers long. They said it would take us 70 to 80 hours to get to the front of the gate, and we did not have enough food or water to wait in the car for 70 or 80 hours. So we decided, okay, we are going to walk, because if we walk, it will take us 14 to 15 hours. So eventually we got to the Polish border, and then it was complete chaos. Thousands of people telling us that they've been here for 5 days, they've been here for 4 days, for 4 nights, with no shelter, no water, no food, no toilets. They prioritized the Ukrainian people, the Ukrainian women and children. You've got women from other nationalities that standing there in the cold, they're not doing anything to them. They had us in this small block where everyone had to stand. People were fighting, breaking bottles. I was concerned for my safety there. And then eventually some guy in the military told me, like, dude, just go to another border because they're not going to let anyone in. The people are freaking out here. So then I decided to go back to Lviv. I turned around. I spent $1,000. I walked for 25 kilometers. I wasted almost 2 days. And here I just go back to Lviv as if I wasted everything to waste. I mean, by then I almost had like 50 hours with no sleep. So I really needed one full night's rest before I can take on another plan for the next day. And then I met up with a fellow South African that was also in Lviv. And he said he needs to go. I told him, yes, man, I'm also alone. Let's meet together. So we go to the Lviv railway. Same story. Absolute chaos. The boards are wrong. The boards in the train, in the railway station, tells you, yeah, this train going there is coming this time on this platform. Then you go there that time on that platform, and then another train arrives going into the eastern direction, back to Kharkiv or back to Kiev or back to Zaporozhye. We get this taxi driver. We're telling him, like, yeah, man, can you take us? He's a Bolt driver. Can you take us to Uzhgorod? Uzhgorod is the town where you can go to the either the Slovakian border or the Hungarian border. And he says, no, there's too many military checkpoints. There's too much snow. It's snowing. I can't take you. The people charge you like $1,000 again. So I was like, oh, no, I don't have this money anymore. And he's like, okay, he might have an idea. He calls a bus driver. The bus driver tells him he already left from Lviv to Uzhgorod, but he's not far. So the taxi driver offers to catch up with the bus driver. And we're like, yeah, thank God.
Johann got to that bus and made it across the border, but countless others are stuck in a situation of utter terror.
We've got at least 350 South African students that studies medical and whatever, and most of them are on their fourth year, and you've got universities being bombed. So what's going to happen
with their 4 years of studies? I mean, where are they going to go? They wasted 4 years money, 4 years studies. They have no plan, nothing.
I mean, South African people do not have a lot of money. Most of them are there on scholarships. I can just imagine what that must feel like.
Johann Nell. We reached him in Budapest last week. Now, Joshua Yaffa, who's normally our Moscow correspondent, has been traveling throughout the war zone in Ukraine for weeks. And Masha Gessen has been in the Russian capital reporting on the politics and the response to the invasion there. I spoke to them both late last week. It's a privilege to speak to you both. And we're speaking on Thursday. The city of Kherson has fallen. Kharkiv is under bombardment, as are other cities. Now, Josh, you spent the night in a, not in a bomb shelter, but in a metro station, which is now in effect a bomb shelter. What were people saying?
I mean, they were, you know, people are there because they're seeing, especially in places like Kharkiv in Ukraine's northeast, they're seeing apartment blocks being hit with cluster munitions. They're seeing people fall dead in the streets as rocket fire rains down on them from above. And so, you know, to get to the point where you're coming night after night and sleeping on a rolled up blanket on the cold cement floor of a subway station suggests or sort of belies a level
of really terror
and dread that is quite real and quite palpable in the city and really makes people quite angry. And I think that's on the one hand totally understandable, if not obvious, right? There's the degree of absolute just fury that I've found among just about everyone I talk to in Kiev these days, and certainly the people who are spending the night in this metro station, how angry they are at Putin, how angry they are at Russia. And that really gets to the issue of the utter futility of this war, not just in its human cost and the horror that is already inflicted and is will continue to inflict for some days and I'm afraid weeks to come, but it just beggars the mind as to what Putin was thinking here. In other words, all wars have some kind of political solution. Clearly, Putin had something in mind when he invaded Ukraine, and that something presumably was some sort of new pro-Russian government built in the ashes of the Ukrainian state that Putin was sent on destroying. But the degree of and passion and depth of anger here that people have toward Russia, and these are not people I'm not, you know, pushing or prompting people. I'm asking the most open-ended questions, even just sometimes as simple as, you know, hi, how are you in the metro? And there's the degree of absolute anger you get toward Russia makes this whole idea that this country could ever, you know, go along with or submit itself to rule installed at the barrel of a gun from Moscow just makes the whole project seem so impossible and therefore so much more futile and really dark.
Masha, you just left Moscow. Tell me what kind of support this war has. We know that the airways are flooded with pro-war propaganda, anti-Ukrainian, anti-Western propaganda, but you're actually speaking to people. Who's for this?
Right. Well, it's hard to tell. But actually, can I pick up on something that Josh said first. Sure. Because, you know, I was thinking as I was listening to you, Josh, it makes no sense that he would imagine that that he could bring Ukraine to its knees, and like, what would he do even if he bombs Kiev out of existence and installs what he thinks is a puppet government? But the thing is that I think what he's thinking is that he has the experience of having done that. In 1994 and again in 2000, Moscow bombed the everything out of Grozny, and then it installed a puppet dictator who somehow manages to, you know, through sheer terror, manages to run a Putin fiefdom in Chechnya. And so there's, if you go to Grozny, you will see portraits of Putin, and it is the absolute image of a land where people fought a people's war of resistance that has been completely subjugated. And so I think that's what he imagines will happen with Ukraine. And I think he's probably been assured to the extent that he consults with anybody, but I think he's been assured by his military men that they could take Ukraine fast and sort of do the same thing. And I think he believed that Ukrainians were waiting for him with open arms. Now, to the question of who supports this war, I mean, I have talked to people who support the war. And although it's not the war as we see it that they support, because what they're seeing on television is very, very different, right? The newscasts in Russia tell you that Russia is involved in a peacekeeping, I kid you not, a peacekeeping operation. Sometimes they call it a peacekeeping operation, sometimes they call it a special operation for the cessation of hostilities. It's a really Orwellian sort of framing. And Russians are convinced, on the one hand, that that they're fighting pure evil, right? That Ukrainians are Nazis. They also think that they're fighting the United States and Ukraine as a proxy. But on the other hand, they have no images of the actual war, right? What Russian television is showing are refugees from the Donbas area who are saying that they're fleeing Ukrainians, who are receiving gratefully humanitarian aid. There's really no blood and gore. There's very, very little imagery of damaged buildings or streets. But even if you see them, you don't see sort of the devastated cities. You see a village that has had a missile hit it, and the Russians claim that it was the Ukrainians. Right. So they imagine a completely different thing.
But Masha, this is the digital age. You know, speaking about whether Putin can stay in control as a leader, the former British ambassador to Russia, Sir Roderick Lyne, told the BBC recently that Putin's biggest weakness now is the mobile phone. Ukrainians are calling up their friends and relatives in Russia, and they're sending pictures of the truth into Russia. So the truth is going to get in, and Putin can't stop that. That's what Roderick Lyne said. What do you make of that argument?
I think it may be overstating the facts for two big reasons. One is that people are often really resistant to factual interventions in their belief systems and in their ideologies. I have talked to people in the last few days who have relatives in Ukraine. I mean, in some way or another, pretty much anybody you run into in Russia has a connection to Ukraine, right? If it's not family, it's somebody that they knew through work, somebody they studied with. For a lot of middle class and higher people, it's people who provided domestic help, right? Often nannies that raised them, right? So close connections. And what they say is that, you know, those people have been brainwashed by the Ukrainian Nazis, and they don't know what's happening. They dismiss the images that they receive as fakes. So that's one reason, right? Is this desire to push away any information that interferes with a worldview and an ideology. And the other, possibly even bigger problem, is that Putin has really destroyed the public sphere, including the digital public sphere. Right? We don't, you know, when we talk about people getting pictures of the truth, we're not really talking about individuals, right? We imagine that there are sort of networks and people exchange these pictures and they make their way online and they bubble up to bigger media and then they trickle down again to individual people, and that information circulates, but information doesn't circulate. Just in the last week, Russia has lost two of its main independent media outlets. And a third one, Novaya Gazeta, led by the Peace Prize, Nobel Peace Prize winner Dmitry Muratov, today announced that it had decided to submit to censorship.
Josh, you've lived in Moscow now for 10 years. Lots of people you know have left the country. Lots of people you know, Masha, have left the country. And a person I talked to, who was a presenter on TV Rain, one of the outlets that's been shut down, said the country has been completely transformed. That sanctions and the feeling of wartime Russia as an invader has completely transformed the economics and the psychology of the Moscow they knew. Josh, can you respond to that? I know that you're in Ukraine, but I'm sure you're wired into Moscow as well.
Yeah, it's been interesting to listen and read Masha over the last few days to get a glimpse into a city and a world that I've known so well for years, but yet am following with just absolute horror and confusion at how quickly things have changed. And we always knew that any war that Russia launched in Ukraine would not just be absolutely devastating for Ukraine, but utterly transformative for Russia as well. And that seems to be exactly what's happening. And it's been disorienting and strange to watch that from afar. I've been in Ukraine now for almost a month, and I've seen and certainly heard, in terms of talks with friends and following along with what's happening in Moscow from people I've known well and known for some years, it just what an utterly, I don't want to say unrecognizable place it is, because we've been on this trajectory for a while. You've written about it. Masha has written about it at length. You know, Russia was not a flourishing, open, healthy democracy 2 weeks ago, far from it. But the phase we're entering into now is quite dark. It's dark because of the economic effects for real people. These are millions of people who already have seen 20 plus years of Putin's rule. And now we'll see that continue for an indefinite period of time, but in a much harsher reality, living in a country that's essentially akin to Venezuela or Iran in terms of its international isolation. It's hard to get money into Moscow these days. It's hard to fly in or out of Moscow these days. In fact, that's almost impossible, really, to get anywhere internationally from Moscow. Whether that actually raises a real political danger for Putin and the stability of his rule, I'm not sure. I think that Putin has organized his system in such a way as to really disassociate or prevent discontent from actually reaching the political system itself and causing any direct threat to him. So I think we may be stuck with this really dark system and sort of dark arrangement of power, almost close to a military dictatorship than the kind of postmodern authoritarianism we've seen in Russia of late. So I'm afraid the story for Russia itself is quite dark.
Well, Masha, you were recently at some protests, but the crackdown seems to be coming hard and fast, and there's even talk of martial law in Moscow, if not throughout Russia. That's entirely speculative, but that's very much the talk of Moscow, as I understand it, and beyond. What would that mean?
Well, we don't know, but people fear most that the borders will close, right? The rumor that's circulating is that tomorrow, Friday, there's going to be an emergency joint session of parliament. This we know, that there's going to be an emergency joint session of parliament, and that they're going to declare a state of emergency or martial law and prevent people between the ages of 18 and 50, people of both sexes, from leaving the country. I wouldn't be terribly surprised to find out that this was a rumor spread to induce all the people who would leave the country to hurry up and leave the country. I wouldn't be terribly surprised if we don't actually see martial law or a state of emergency come down tomorrow. But I think right now the regime is doing everything to force all of its enemies out of the country, and then at a certain point, yes, they're going to close the borders and put everyone who's perceived as enemy who's still inside in prison.
I hear from a lot of Ukrainians, Masha, saying Russia can't win this war, and if they win the cities in the short term and they subdue and pulverize these cities, that they will be engaged in a prolonged guerrilla war with Ukrainians. What about this claim? Are the Ukrainians just trying to get themselves to be brave and endure, which would be perfectly understandable, or strategically or even tactically, can they win a war against Russian aggression?
You know, I have no doubt that, I wouldn't say that they can win a war, but I'm certain that Ukrainians can prevent Russia from winning the war. I think there's no way for Moscow to come to dominate Ukraine. I think that image of Chechnya that Putin has is not transferable to Ukraine. I mean, there was an even more unequal contest, and it also cost Moscow a lot of money to basically buy the shell of a country, that was a shell of a land that was left after Chechnya. I shudder to think that Putin plans to do the same thing in Ukraine, but I don't think he can succeed. So I think the best case scenario is that Russia just gets bogged down in a prolonged conflict with guerrilla fighters.
Josh, how do you think this ends? Is there any way to even know?
I'm afraid not. Like Masha just said, I don't see Ukraine capitulating. It may be militarily defeated in the sense that at a certain point, its regular army may be overwhelmed by the military might that is or are the Russian armed forces. That's a big if. I don't think that's necessarily inevitable. It's clear from the first days of the fighting that the military aspect of this war has not gone at all like Russia thought it would. But in the end, especially if Russia is willing to ratchet up the level of brutality and the level of firepower they're using against Ukraine, they could force through a really ugly military solution. But like Masha just said, I don't see how that translates really ever into a political solution. What you'd be left with is a kind of Northern Ireland scenario, but absolutely on just incredible steroids, incredible and really terrifying steroids in terms of the degree and depth of the violence that could follow for a generation or more. What I think could happen, and I'd be curious to have Masha speak to this, is are there breaks on Putin's behavior in Moscow? Are there any voices who could impel or convince him of a path that I don't think would involve Russian forces packing up and leaving tomorrow? I think that the best, in a way, we could hope for is a kind of negotiated solution. But here, too, it's hard to think of what Ukraine, given the mood in the country, would be willing to give up at this point. I think Ukraine feels like this is an existential battle for its own sense of statehood. So expecting Ukraine to give up on some aspect of that statehood, say, forswearing NATO for all eternity, I think would be a hard thing to get Ukrainians to agree to. But I think the how this ends and the nature of this war going forward really depends in a terrifying way off of the kind of mental space and worldview and understanding of one person, and that's Vladimir Putin.
Masha, can anyone penetrate that reality?
I don't think so. But I think even worse than that, as Josh said, Putin has staked his entire political future on this war. There's no way for him to exit it, to find a non-triumphant solution and retain power. And I don't think there's a way for him to survive not retaining power, to humanly, physically survive not retaining power. He is really cornered. And that's a terrifying situation for the world, not just for Ukraine.
Masha Gessen, Joshua Yaffa, I just want to take the opportunity to thank you for all the work you're doing, and be well. See you soon, I hope.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Masha Gessen, who just left Moscow, and Joshua Yaffa joined us from Kiev. We spoke late on Thursday, and you can find all their reporting on the assault on Ukraine at newyorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Volodymyr Zelensky was once a sitcom star, but now as president of Ukraine, he has emerged as a kind of digital age Churchill, a potent and savvy communicator throughout the Russian invasion of his country.
Слава нашим захисникам, слава нашим захисницям, слава Україні.
Слава Україні.
His emotional appeal to a recent EU meeting, which was video conference from the battlefield, has been credited with spurring European leaders to tougher sanctions, like kicking Russia out of the SWIFT banking system. And so in some ways, at least for now, Ukraine seems to be winning the information war. Igor Novikov is a former advisor to President Zelensky, and he's an internet researcher and entrepreneur. I spoke with Novikov from Kiev last week. Igor, how are you?
I'm fine. Hi.
Полный пи***ц сегодня, да?
Well, exactly. That would be the way I describe it. And we just got some worrying news. Basically, there was a memo issued by the Indian Ministry of Internal Affairs telling Indian citizens to get out of Kharkiv before 6 p.m., including on foot if necessary. So I've no idea what they're planning on doing tonight in Kharkiv, but it'll be horrific.
Igor, to be realistic, if not even blunt, for a week now, this invasion has been going on, and the resistance to it has been more than, let's just say, Vladimir Putin might have expected and his military commanders might have expected. But in the end, is it your thinking that he will unleash firepower at an enormous level like we used to see in Grozny and Chechnya?
To be honest, what we're seeing now from Russia is irrational violence, and pretty much borderline intentional genocide, so intended and premeditated. So I would say that, obviously the intensity of the attacks will increase, because Russia is in a bad position militarily at the moment. So unless Putin decides to take a step back and figure out a diplomatic solution and figure out a way to save his face, most likely, yeah, we're going to see some atrocities.
You used the word genocide. What do you mean, and how do you see this as a genocide?
Well, you have to understand the way Putin kind of views Ukraine. You know, for him, we are one people with the Russians, right? So he claims that historically Ukrainians and Russians are one people separated by political and geopolitical circumstances. That is not exactly the case. I mean, Ukrainian people are different in, you know, in their mindset, in their history, in everything pretty much. So, you know, he went in on an assumption that, you know, his troops will be at least partially welcomed with flowers. And that didn't happen. Now the whole of Ukraine is a constant reminder for him that there are liberty and freedom-loving people right next to his totalitarian enclave. So you, basically, you know, I think for him it's personal. And, you know, if he can't force us to love him, he'll do his best to eliminate, I mean, as many Ukrainians as he can, including the elites and the political leadership, to kind of to break the spine of the Ukrainian nation. And in order to do that, he would have to resort to measures not seen in Europe since the 1940s. And we're already kind of witnessing that in Kharkiv, we're witnessing that in Volnovakha, we're witnessing that in Mariupol. And do notice that he's actually bombing Russian-speaking cities in the eastern Ukraine way more than he is, you know, pro-Western Ukrainian cities, right?
Why would he do that? Do you think he wants to hive off Western Ukraine and let it be a separate, more pure, as he would think of it, more purely Ukrainian enclave, and then seize greater control in the east and install a puppet government in Kiev? Is that the scenario you see?
Well, I think they had a number of different scenarios. I mean, definitely from what we've seen, their first and main objective was to change the government of Ukraine and make Ukraine pro-Russian that way. They failed miserably. So now I think they've resorted to plan B, i.e. they're trying to create what they used to call Nova Russia. So
Novaya Russia.
Novorossiya, yeah. So basically, they're trying to take as much territory from the eastern Ukraine as possible, create that land bridge to Crimea, and kind of try and, you know, consolidate all the territories with the Russian-speaking population. But once again, even that plan is doomed to failure because, like, look, even pro-Russians in Ukraine are now turning against Russia. I mean, you don't win hearts and minds with bombs and genocide. I mean, it's a very simple rule, but it's very effective.
Now, you were an advisor to President Zelensky for a year, his first year in office. Have you had any contact with him or people in his circle in recent days?
I'm in contact with the president's office, yes.
And
That's as much as I can say due to, you know, security concerns as well.
And what can you say about Zelensky's thinking? He's doing something extremely 21st century, which is that he's winning a 21st century information war through social media, through his own force of personality. Where does that come from?
Well, I would highlight probably two main elements to that. First of all, obviously, it's the creative side of him. It's the showbiz background. It's the screenwriting, the movie making, you know, because when you come from that background, you're familiar with how to write in the characters, how to develop them, how to develop story arcs, how to make people laugh and cry, how to make people pay attention to what you're doing. So that's the first element. The second element, and that's where my background kind of comes in, is to do with the theory of information, the theory of the so-called attention economy. The first time I met the president, I was doing a one-day academic program for him on how technology affects society and, you know, what the future might hold because of that technological change. And one of the things we actually talked about was, two things. First of all, it was behavioral economics and behavioral psychology, so how people behave differently in, you know, in this day and age. And the second thing that we've actually discussed is this I don't even know how to describe it, this flood of information and how to survive and navigate those turbulent waters. So I gave him the academic sides of it. And then, like, little did we know that, like, literally less than a year later, he's going to be president, I'm going to be his advisor, and we were faced with the biggest story in the world, the Trump impeachment. And that was the first time where we actually had to kind of practice what we preached. So we took everything that we were discussing and using and kind of build a new system to contain information from scratch. So that was the first kind of time. The second time we're seeing now, I mean, look, Ukraine will only survive if people pay attention. And that's really important because, like, look, I can give you one example from history. I mean, if I had to ask you to name at least one astronaut from Apollo 11, you know, the first mission to the moon, can you name one?
Sure. Neil Armstrong.
Yeah, exactly. Can you, Apollo 12 flew like a few months later. Can you name at least one?
I take your point.
You see my point, right? Yeah. So we need to make sure that there's no Apollo 12 effect in, you know, in our war against Russia. So that's issue number one. We have to keep the attention. Secondly, look, it's all about hearts and minds. I mean, people, unfortunately, are irrational at the moment more than usual. So we need to make sure that people understand who the perpetrator and who the victim is in this situation, especially given the fact that we've been attacked by a country well known for its propaganda and probably, you know, one of the best disinformation kind of centers in the world. You know, the country that's weaponized information. And lucky for us, we have a showbiz president who is interested in that kind of stuff and who's not afraid to use kind of the newest advances that we have. And it seems to be working great.
Now, that's the arc of the story, but it's the arc of the story now. And I hate to be like this, but what happens if the arc turns into something quite different, which is to say that the bombardment coming from the Russian army increases to the point of real agony, which is, I think, even quite likely, but one doesn't want to predict. How does the information war continue then? Or does it become then a guerrilla war?
Well, it always has been since the very beginning on February 24th, and it still is a guerrilla war. I mean, we don't have the resources at our disposal that we can utilize as easily as Putin. If things take a turn for the worse, well, first of all, let's talk about the people. I mean, we need to make sure that the humanitarian situation remains bearable. So, you know, women and children are leaving, and they should be leaving at a greater pace and scale if the fighting intensifies. Even those women and children, like, for example, my wife and my daughters, because I have been warned about this like a long time ago. So obviously it was difficult to believe in at first, but, like, you know, I sat my wife down, and she's from Poltava in eastern Ukraine. So sat her down and said, like, look, I mean, I think we should leave, or at least you should leave, okay? Take the kids out. Because I knew if I said you should leave, I should stay, you know, it was a no-go area for that conversation. So I said, like, look, we should leave. And she goes, like, no, we're staying. And I was like, well, you have to understand, I mean, you're putting yourself in grave danger. And she goes, like, look, we're sensible, grown-up human beings, intelligent. You know, we're not stupid enough to run around, like, playing soccer or, you know, walking the kids if the rockets are landing. So we know where the bomb shelter is. We know how to behave. We know how to fight. So we know how to survive. We're staying because this is our home. And she actually told me a very important thing that's become probably my most valued lesson of this whole situation. She told me, like, look, in the world where there are people like Putin who openly wish you death, you know, you can't keep running away because sooner or later you'll have to make a stand. And there's no place better for fighting than your own home.
You undoubtedly heard news of Joe Biden's State of the Union address and his message that Putin will pay a price. How do you evaluate his behavior so far? He's ruled out American troops and air power for reasons you well know. Do you worry that more support or intervention from the West could trigger a wider war, or do you want more?
I support what President Biden does, because, I mean, some people criticize him for a lackluster kind of reaction to the threats. But, I mean, look, I have to remind people that we're dealing with a person who might be mentally unstable, you know, the president of Russia. So in a world where he has that red button at his disposal, you know, we need to fight back, but fight back sensibly, you know. That's the issue number one. Issue number two, in terms of American boots on the ground, I mean, we love our country and we're ready to defend our country, and we would appreciate American boots on the ground. Obviously, the more the merrier, but I mean, we're not in desperate need of other people dying for our country against their will, just because the government decided. What we really need is weapons. I appreciate that the West is really concerned that the first Russian plane shot down by a NATO member country could lead to Third World War and potentially to a nuclear war. So, but we need to, at the same time, figure out a way to give Ukraine a chance in the air as well, because most of the damage that's happening now is happening because Russia controls a large percentage of Ukrainian airspace. We do have some fighter jets. We do have some anti-aircraft systems, right? But, you know, obviously Russia is far superior in terms of its hardware. So, you know, the very fact that we're actually shooting down their planes and helicopters and cruise missiles is a miracle.
Tell me at what point your family does leave Ukraine, or are you there till the bitter end, or until there is a moment where the chokehold is released?
I would put it this way. First of all, I'd separate myself from my family in that particular sense. So my family would leave when there is an imminent threat to their security. Like, although we're in a hotspot at the moment, I have the situation under control. And if you don't mind, I won't go into the details. If I deem the situation too dangerous, they will leave against their will. So that's issue number one. Issue number two, I'm not leaving. Like, look, even if Putin razes every inch of our country to the ground, we'll take this fight elsewhere. So whatever happens, Ukrainian people and Ukrainian nation will survive this.
Igor Novikov, thank you so much. And best to your family.
Thanks very much.
Igor Novikov, a former advisor to President Zelensky, and we spoke on Wednesday. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The critic Pauline Kael used to say that she lost it at the movies. And if that phrase sounds a little erotic, she meant it to be. As the New Yorker's film critic from 1968 to around 1991, she always gave voice to her most visceral reactions to the movies. There was nothing snobbish, nothing airy about her movie going or her writing. And 50 years ago, in March of 1972, she wrote about a new film on the scene. It was called The Godfather. Here's Edie Falco reading from Pauline Kael's review.
If ever there was a great example of how the best popular movies come out of a merger of commerce and art, The Godfather is it.
I believe in America. America has made my fortune. And I raised my daughter in the American fashion.
The movie starts from a trash novel that's generally considered gripping and compulsively readable, though maybe because movies more than satisfy my appetite for trash, I found it unreadable. It features a Sinatra stereotype and sex and slaughter and little gobbets of truth and heartbreak.
You gotta get up close like this, and bada-bing, you blow their brains all over your nice Ivy League suit. Come Sonny. In. Mwah! You're taking this very personal. Tom, this is business, and this man is taking it very, very personal.
Where does it say
it's gripping, maybe, in the same sense that Spiro Agnew's speeches were a few years back. Puzo, who admits he was out to make money, wrote, "Below my gifts," as he put it, and one must agree. Francis Ford Coppola uses his gifts to reverse the process. He has salvaged Puzo's energy and lent the narrative dignity. The abundance is from the book. The quality of feeling is Coppola's.
It's not personal, Sonny. It's strictly business.
The beginning is set late in the summer of 1945. The film's roots, however, are in the gangster films of the early 30s.
Leave the gun. Take the cannoli.
The plot is still about rival gangs murdering each other. But now we see the system of patronage and terror in which killing is a way of dealing with the competition.
What I want, what's most important to me, is that I have a guarantee. No more attempts on my father's life.
What guarantees can I give you, Mike? I am the hunted one. I missed my chance.
The men meet and conduct their business in deep-toned, shuttered rooms, lighted by lamps even in the daytime. The killing, connived at in the darkness, is the secret horror, and it surfaces in one bloody outburst after another. The recognition that the killing is an integral part of business policy takes us a long way from the fantasy outlaws of old movies. There is no one on the screen we can identify with, unless we take a fancy to the pearly teeth of one shark in a pool of sharks.
I want you to rest well, and a month from now, this Hollywood big shot's going to give you what you want.
It's too late. They start shooting in a week.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
The enormous cast is headed by Marlon Brando as Don Vito Corleone. Don Vito could be played as a magnificent old warrior, a noble killer, a handsome bull patriarch. But Brando doesn't play for statuesque nobility.
You talk about vengeance. Is vengeance going to bring your son back to you? Or my boy to me?
The light, cracked voice comes out of a twisted mouth and clenched teeth.
I spend my life trying not to be careless. Women and children can be careless, but not men.
He has the battered face of a devious, combative old man and a pugnacious thrust to his jaw. His Don is a primitive, sacred monster, and the more powerful because he suggests not the strapping sacred monsters of movies, but actual ones. Those old men who carry never-ending grudges and ancient hatreds inside a frail frame. Those monsters who remember minute details of old business deals when they can no longer tie their shoelaces. If the movie gangster once did express, as Robert Warshaw suggested in the late 40s, that part of the American psyche which rejects the qualities and the demands of modern life, which rejects Americanism itself, that was the attitude of another era. In The Godfather, we see organized crime as an obscene symbolic extension of free enterprise and government policy, an extension of the worst in America, its feudal ruthlessness. Organized crime is not a rejection of Americanism. It's what we fear Americanism to be. It's our nightmare of the American system. When Americanism was a form of cheerful, bland, official optimism, the gangster used to be destroyed at the end of the movie and our feelings resolved. Now the mood of the whole country has darkened, guiltily. Nothing is resolved at the end of The Godfather because the family business goes on. The Godfather is popular melodrama, but it expresses a new, tragic realism.
That's Edie Falco reading from Pauline Kael's review in our March 10th, 1972 issue. You can find Kael's whole piece on the film, and the pieces were quite a bit longer back in the day, at newyorker.com. Much of Pauline Kael's best work is collected in a volume called The Age of Movies from the Library of America. That's the New Yorker Radio Hour for today. Thanks for joining us. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Ave Carrillo, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Harrison Keithline, and Mengfei Chen, and guidance from Emily Botine. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science. Neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.